You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. Welcome to the program, A Good Book. I'm your volunteer reader, Lee Close, and I am also the author of the book I will be reading. The title is Late for the Bus, An Adoption Story, Finding My Birth Parents, Jerry and Joanne Buss. The true story of finding my birth parents after years of fruitless searching, only to discover that I'm the eldest daughter of Dr. Gerald Buss, the multimillionaire, legendary owner of the Los Angeles Lakers, and his wife, Joanne. This is part two of the program. In part one, we started with introducing you to my adoptive family, my grandparents, and also my parents. And now in part two, we'll begin with when Jimmy, my adoptive father, met Maddie, my adoptive mother. Exactly how or when Jimmy met Maddie is unknown to me, but it may have been during one of Maddie's vacations back to her childhood home of Texarkana in either 1929 or 1931. They may have worked together in some capacity in Los Angeles around 1937, as evidenced by the letter below referencing back pay. Jimmy returned to Texas sometime after that. In beautiful handwriting, he wrote a letter to her on January 16, 1938, postmarked Waco, Texas. It was sent airmail and addressed to her home on East 43rd Street in Los Angeles. I wrote you a letter in San Antonio the other day, but before I could mail it, I went to the post office here today and got your sweet letter. I sure was picked up when I got it, because I was feeling kind of low. Honey, smoke sure got in my eyes when I told you goodbye that night, and I hope it never happens again. Leaving you, I mean. I am enjoying myself here, except for one thing, and that is you, honey. I guess I didn't realize how much you mean to me until I left you, and my chin started quivering. Great consolation to know that you love me and are waiting for me to come back or come to me. I don't think I will be able to find anything in Waco unless it is with my uncle here. If you can get me in with that guy in Dallas, I will take anything he can or will offer. I would work for just enough for us to live on if I could have you for all mine and to make a home, if nothing but a dump. I would not be able to give you the little things in life that sometimes mean so much to one when they are accustomed to them especially. We could live good down here on 20 per week, as things are so much cheaper in Texas. I am really surprised at how cheap they are. Really, I am, as Jenny says. Honey, write as soon as you hear from that guy, as I will be ready to come back by the first week of February. Sweetie pie, try to find out from someone when we are to get our back pay and let me know right away. I am about as flat as I missed connections on the train in San Antonio the other day and had to lay over 24 hours. I was misinformed all the way down the line as I was told to transfer to Katy at San Antonio, and I thought all along that they were wrong as my ticket was punched to San Antonio all the way. They told me I was crazy, but it turned out that they were the ones who were crazy. Honey, tell everybody hello and give yourself a big kiss and tell yourself over and over, I love you, I love you, because that is what I want so bad to say it again. Take care, my darling, and don't let anybody run over you. Give them hell, honey, and pull for me to find something so we can be together soon, as I am longing to hold you in my arms again. Write soon, and remember, I love you deeply. Lots and lots of love. Your Jimmy. Jimmy made it back to sunny California, and with the help of Maddie's father, got a job with the railroad. They were a playful, well-matched pair. Jimmy, a handsome young man with swimming pool blue eyes and thick, wavy, jet black hair, and Maddie, tall and thin, with long, flowing dark hair and eyes, a dancer's set of legs, and an outgoing personality. They loved to go dancing and drinking, ballrooms, dance halls. They had a large circle of friends, including Cecil, a man who worked at the Max Factor studio in Hollywood as a hairdresser to the stars. He taught Maddie how to style her long, wavy hair into a braid or a bun with glamorous makeup to accent her strong bone structure and deep-set eyes. Jimmy and Maddie were having the time of their lives. Big city, big dreams, big fun. Glamour girl from Los Angeles meets country boy from Waco. Their common thread was the Southern upbringing they each treasured, but wanted no part of anymore, choosing instead the values and freedom of living in the Golden West. They spent more time together, fell in love, and married in June of 1939 in Santa Ana, Orange County, California. Still newlyweds, Maddie and Jimmy each purchased a life insurance policy from the Paul Revere Life Insurance Company on April 2, 1940. For $1,000 and his for $1,600. Their life together was officially beginning, and they were planning ahead. On October 16, 1940, at the age of 25, Jimmy was one of many young men required to register for the draft. This was the country's first peacetime draft. The newlyweds were living on 53rd Street in Los Angeles. Jimmy was a pacifist and had some type of exemption, but never spoke about it. In 1941, as the war was heating up in Europe, he took courses in stenography and court reporting at Webster College in Los Angeles. With his pacifist views and administration skills, had he been drafted, he may have served his country as a secretary. America was not yet involved in World War II, other than President Franklin Roosevelt offering aging American Navy destroyers to Great Britain. For Jimmy and Maddie, life in California was peaceful and happy. They enjoyed several driving vacations with friends in Wrightwood, a resort town in the San Gabriel Mountains with an elevation of 6,000 feet. Even though it was only 40 miles from Los Angeles, Wrightwood was in the pines with lots of snow in the winter. They loved to go tobogganing in the daytime and play poker and drink and smoke cigarettes late into the night. Another favorite vacation spot was Lone Pine, about 200 miles from Los Angeles, up in the Sierra Nevada mountain range, a scenic area used for filming Western movies. The thrill of Maddie's life was being an extra on the set of a Hopalong Cassidy, Bill Boyd, movie. She had her picture taken with him while seated together during a break on the movie set, looking casual yet glamorous in light-colored pants and top, with her long black hair wrapped in a turban. The star of the movie was in his full Western regalia, black cowboy hat and all. "He's the good guy, you know," she would explain, "and so handsome." After a decade of carefree living, and now in their mid-30s, Jimmy and Maddie began to settle down but realized they were unable to have children. They asked their doctor about adoption. He was more than willing to help them. By the time they were ready to adopt their first child, Jimmy was a full-time administrator for the Pacific Electric Railway Company. He served as part of the Pacific Electric Speakers Forum from July to October 1948. Although he did not serve in the military and therefore unable to benefit from the GI Bill, he continued to progress with the railroad without a college degree. 1 month later, in early November of 1948, they would bring their first adopted child home, a daughter they named Christine, and just 2 years later purchased their first home on Elser Drive in Duarte, a small town with a big history, full of orange groves and avocado trees. Their new home was a single-story, 900-square-foot ranch-style home, painted white with dark green shutters. There was a long driveway and a big fenced backyard. By the time they considered adopting another child, Jimmy was enjoying a dynamic career. He was involved in local collective bargaining and trade union administration. In 1952, he completed a course in transport management labor relations at UCLA's Institute of Industrial Relations School of Business Administration. He attended a four-month seminar at Harvard from February to May of 1953, receiving a certificate of completion of the trade union program at the Litauer School of Public Administration, Graduate School of Business Administration, and the Department of Economics. He joined attendees from all over the United States and Europe and made friends with several, corresponding with them for years. His brief time at Harvard was the highlight of his career, and upon his return, his business card read, General Secretary Treasurer, Brotherhood of Railway and Steamship Clerks, 755 Pacific Electric Building, Los Angeles, 14, California. In August of 1953, Jimmy and Maddie would receive the phone call they had been waiting for from their doctor, letting them know a baby would be on the way soon and to get ready. Jerry and Joanne, my biological parents, each only 20 years old, had made the decision to place me for adoption. 3 days after my birth, they met Jimmy and Maddie, who were 39 and 40, and relinquished all parental rights as they handed me over to my new parents. Once an adoption order is granted, it is almost never reversed. My new mom and dad brought me home, describing me to everyone as their new baby girl with the big brown eyes. Big brown eyes would become quite valuable to me later on during the search for my family of origin. Although it had no possible relevance at the time, in 1953, the year of my birth, the NBA championship was won by the Minneapolis Lakers, who beat the New York Knickerbockers 4-3. The Lakers would move to Los Angeles in 1960, an event that would definitely become relevant later on. In 1956, our family of four moved from Duarte to Southgate and rented a house across the street from my adoptive maternal grandparents, Carl and Mary, who owned a large piece of property with two homes and a small apartment. My mom's sister, my Aunt Faye, and her husband, my Uncle George, and their son, G.H., lived in a smaller home on the back of the property. My grandfather, Carl, was in ill health, and my mom wanted to be near her parents at this time. One Sunday, I wandered off from my new, unfamiliar home. My mom found me walking down the street with my children's Bible in hand. I had been knocking on doors, and if someone answered, I would tell them about Jesus, the extent of my knowledge being the songs I had learned in vacation Bible school. This wasn't the only time I wandered away. I loved to skip up and down the bumpy, cracked sidewalks that had risen up from the roots of the big magnolia trees. Along one wall, around the corner from my grandmother's house, was a planter full of multicolored lantana that I would pick for tiny bouquets to give to my family. They were pretty, but didn't smell very good. No one complained. I don't remember exactly when my parents told me that I was adopted, but it may have been about the same time I was learning how to ride a tricycle. Neither event caused me much worry. By the fall of this same year, in 1956, a few miles away, Jerry and Joanne Buss, my biological parents, would give birth to their second child, my biological brother. this child would not be placed for adoption. Johnny Buss became the official eldest child of the Buss family. Chapter 2, Scenes of Childhood. Sometimes you will never know the value of a moment until it becomes a memory. Dr. Seuss. 1959-1960, first grade, Duarte, California. My grandfather recovered and we settled back into our home in Duarte. My first grade experience in the fall of 1959 was at Maxwell Grade School, and from the beginning I was excited about this new idea called school. Our class took naps each day, resting on a towel placed on the floor. The one I brought from home had Neapolitan colors, vanilla, strawberry, and chocolate, in repeating 1-inch stripes. I hung on to that towel for years, for reasons unknown, other than it reminded me of ice cream. I loved to play outside on the front lawn, and one day I saw my dad remove one of the outside shutters that framed the living room window. Hiding underneath was a black widow spider. My dad motioned for me to come closer. He touched the spider web with his finger. "See this? You know it's a black widow web because it's real sticky." Then he pointed to the red hourglass on her belly. "The bite of a black widow spider is poisonous. Stay away, little one." A tender-hearted warning I would never forget. In the autumn of that same year, 1959, about 20 miles from my home in Duarte, Jerry and Joanne Buss, my biological parents, would give birth to their third child, my second biological brother, Jimmy. While we were living in Duarte, my grandfather Carl passed away on January 11, 1960. It was my first viewing of a body at a wake. There were many people there, and when it was my turn to walk up to the casket, I saw his quiet face and waxen skin. I knew he was not sleeping. He was dressed in a suit. I cannot remember him alive. The viewing is my only memory of him. Sometimes life changes in an instant. It happened in our family. The stress of being involved in railroad labor union negotiations started to take a toll on my dad. I knew something was not right, but it was beyond my understanding. Christine was in sixth grade at the time and was better able to reason what was happening. She recently shared her memory of that day, writing, "Yes, it was in Duarte that he had his breakdown. I remember it was Saturday morning, and Mom was working at the malt shop. I may have ridden up there to tell her about it, but I can't be sure. I'm not completely sure it was a Saturday, but I know he seemed strange and was wearing his Saturday clothes. I remember asking him where he was going, and he said work, which I thought was strange since he didn't have on work clothes. I remember it was a plaid shirt, but not much else about it. The other thing I found strange was he didn't take his car. It was a white, I think, coupe kind of car that was parked on the street, and he didn't get in it to go to work that day. I also remember riding in the car with Mom, and we saw him walking down a street. Must have been after I told her what happened. I remember he went to a sanatorium after that. At least that's what she said. Neither my sister nor I can recall how long he was away or where he went for recovery, but we knew it was serious. Even after his return home, he seemed different, often quiet and seemingly lost in thought. But my mom's approach was one of reassurance that all would be well. Our daily routine returned to normal, with one exception. Dad no longer went to work each day. He did not return to the career he worked so hard to attain and loved so much. He never discussed what happened to him with my sister and me. In a letter written several years after his breakdown, dated June 1, 1968, he discussed his health with his friend, Lord John Cooper, a new member of the House of Lords who lived in Surrey, England, and one of the many friends he had met while at Harvard in 1953. In this letter, my dad wrote that he had encountered some severe health problems and that these problems had caused me to leave my union office in 1960. Once he was settled back at home, Mom started signing the letters my dad had composed to be sent to the Railroad Retirement Board requesting a disability annuity. Several letters went back and forth, and below is an excerpt from one of the letters they received. Under the law, his condition must be so severe that it prevents him from doing substantial work in any occupation. On the basis of medical evidence we have in your case, we find that your condition, despite the extent to which it has affected you, does not meet this requirement. With his career on hold, Dad would sit at the kitchen table in the mornings and read the newspaper. He would become a lifelong reader of Leon Uris and James A. Michener, and in the evenings he would sit in a chair in the living room with a book in hand and a table lamp by his side. He never minded my interruptions, of which there were many. He would look up from what he was reading when I would come into the room, smile, and give me his complete attention and ask, "Do you want to dance?" "Yes." He would get up from his chair and I would step onto his big black wingtip shoes and hold on to his fingers for balance. He would lift up his shoes with mine and pretend we were dancing all around the room. It was magical. Even though Dad was not working, Mom's cheerful spirit brought in good money as a waitress. If it was a struggle, they always presented a positive and united front. Their social life continued. There would be no somber days and nights for them. No yelling, no drama. My mom and dad were liberal Democrats and enjoyed a large circle of friends who were active in politics and local clubs. In July 1960, they attended the fourth session of the Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles, where John F. Kennedy would win the presidential nomination. Dad loved all that Kennedy stood for and saved the entry ticket as a keepsake. Hope for the future kept them going. Summer of 1960, Waco, Texas. Soon after the convention, my parents sold their home in Duarte, and in early August, we packed up and moved to my dad's childhood home of Waco, Texas. As a six-year-old with tons of energy, I never asked why we were leaving. I just loved getting in the car and going somewhere, anywhere. It was my first time in the state of Texas, which was so different than California. For me, a trip to downtown Waco meant that after we parked the car on the street, I was met with the challenge of climbing up the steep curbs before I could run down the sidewalks lining the storefronts. So much for the memory of a city. Out in the country, we visited my dad's sister, Tessie Lee. That's where I met my kissing cousin Bart at his parents' turkey ranch. He had a go-kart, and I watched him race around in the dirt, going in circles, dust flying everywhere. He made me nervous and made me laugh at the same time. "You're going to break your neck with that thing." I may have said it more like thang, because I loved to mimic my dad when he would put on his Texas drawl. He could turn it on or off whenever he saw fit. My mom could too. And in their strongest southern accent came a running joke in the house that went like this. "Pa, supper's on the stove." "Well, Ma, scrape it off and we'll eat it." Then after the meal, they would continue. "Well, I've ate sufficient."
"You went fishing?"
"No, I said I've had plenty."
"And caught 20.
Oh,
poor old fool, and fell in the pool. It didn't matter how many times I heard this. I couldn't help but giggle at their silliness. It actually got funnier as they got older. Little sound bites like this stay with you all of your life. We left Waco at the end of summer. It was the only visit we ever made as a family to Texas. I never saw my cousin Bart again. I never saw any of my Texas relatives again. My sister recapped her memory of that summer, writing, "I do remember the turkey ranch with Bart. I think it was in Hearne, Texas. I remember Aunt Tessie Lee's farm and eating yellow watermelon. I know we moved to Phoenix after Waco, and I did not want to move there. I had seen a movie about a kid that got kidnapped in Phoenix, and I didn't want to go." We left Texas, but we did not move back to California. Instead, we moved to Phoenix, Arizona. I was all for the idea of going to a new destination in our car. Christine once remarked that all of our moves were about as close to a summer vacation as we would ever get. That's just about all the time we have for today. Join us on the next program for the continuation of Late for the Bus, an adoption story by Lee Close, author of the book and also your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you so much for joining me today.